Thank you very much. It's a lovely opportunity to be here today. Chala had to coax this out of me because I've given variations of this talk to a number of different audiences around Australia, because ever since I came to Australia to teach at the National Film School, I've been helping filmmakers, content creators, media creators, TV people, whoever they are, get their minds around what's really going on the 21st century. Now, I only have 20 minutes today, so I'm going to be unadulterated, uncensored, and unapologetic. So fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy download. Part one, the fear of God. So, in the beginning, which we'll fix at 1995, there was Real Player, and it was good. Because you could get your content up, you could encode it, you could put it on a website, and people could download it and play with it. It was really nice, and so people everywhere started putting up their own video content. Only there was a problem. The problem didn't reveal itself immediately, but the problem has been building, and it's been building since people started putting content up. And the problem is the way people share the content they like. What we've seen now, particularly in the last few years, about the way that we share content is really revealing. Let's say you wake up, and some people check email first thing in the morning. I wait till I've done my yoga and had a coffee, and I'll sit down. Some people wait till they come into the office, and you'll check your email. And in the email will be some business emails, and you'll deal with those a little later, and maybe some emails from family. And then there's emails from friends. And those emails from friends are very telling, because pretty much these days they're, oh, look at this, or oh, read this, or oh, listen to this. And they just have a link in time. And more of our email is more and more like that, because what we're doing right now is we're finding things and we're filtering them by who we think are going to be interested in them, and then we forward them around to our friends. I call this the three F's: finding, filtering, and forwarding. And this has become the way that we each, as individuals, have become our own broadcasting networks. We use the three F's in practice. And so what happens is, if you have something like your Real video up there, and someone finds it and they like it and they tell someone who then forwards it on and on and on, all of a sudden you have 5 or 10,000 people who are hitting your poor little web server trying to get your little Real video up. Now, one of two things happens at that point. Either your web server melts down, or your ISP calls and says, you owe us $3,500. Eek. Now, this is netcasting, and in 1995 it was the bomb. It was really, really great. But again, if you got popular because somehow it filtered its way out into these distribution networks that we're all a part of now, and it got popular, which is what you want, you pay an enormous price for it. And of course, you can take a look and see the difference between the ABC website and the SBS website. Now, SBS just upgraded clearly for the World Cup, because going to the SBS website, say, last month was incredibly painful. You wait forever for pages to load. The ABC, always like this. Why? Because the ABC pays an enormous amount of money to have an enormous infrastructure to support the fact that Australians are all hitting that website. SBS, not so concerned. You're going to wait 30 seconds for the Nerds FC page to load, and I did. So netcasting is great until things get popular. When it gets popular, you get into trouble. And then in 1999, Napster came along. And it was very good. Of course, unless you were a recording executive. Napster is probably the most important innovation in music technology since the invention of the phonograph. It's what we would call super distribution. What that means is that when you logged into the Napster network, your hard disk would become a perfect harmonious one with millions of other hard disks on millions of computers all across the world, and you could search the contents of those different computers, find what you wanted on those different computers, and then download it to your own hard disk. And that's really cool. And the thing about it being really cool is it changed the way we thought. It changed the way we looked at a computer. We changed the way we thought about broadband. All of these things changed because of Napster, and even though Napster isn't around anymore, we're still thinking the same way about media. So Napster creates what we call super distribution, which is the fact that you now have this gigantic interlinked hard disk. And of course, there are issues around copyright violation here. We all know this. Napster was sued out of existence by record companies that could not stand a wholesale violation of their intellectual property. But the people on the street, you and I, loved it. It changed the way we thought about music. It changed the way we used music. And when you and I want something, when masses of people want something badly enough, there's nothing that any industry or any government can do about it. You cannot stand up to a swarm, it doesn't matter who you are, of millions of people who want what they want. Let me give you a little example here. In evolution, you have hunters and prey. And what will happen? So you have hunters trying to attack the prey, and the prey will change themselves, so maybe they don't taste good to the hunter, and the hunter will change itself so it can digest what doesn't taste good. Take a look at the cane toad. Cane toad has evolved poison sacs, which make it basically unpalatable as a food. And so as the various recording companies went after Napster, they forced the swarm of people who were using Napster to think really hard about how to evolve strategies to make themselves invisible or untasty to the record companies. And so from Napster, you then get Kazaa, you get Nutella, you get now more invisible networks that are harder to track. And so now, far more people are file sharing than were ever file sharing in the days of Napster. And they're doing so invisibly because the pressure that's been put on them by the recording industry in order to maintain control of their copyright forced all of these systems to evolve so that the copyright owners couldn't track them anymore. So, a very bad thing. Still, peer-to-peer networks, and this is the first real good example of peer-to-peer networks, they're not that perfect. If there's only one copy of something out there, and you find it because you've searched the peer-to-peer network and you find it and you click on it, you then enter a queue of people who are downloading that. And if that thing is very popular, you might be way, way back in that queue. And if you're way, way back in that queue, and then the user with that computer with that file on it decides to turn the computer off, you're out of luck. You can't do anything about it. So as wonderful as this is, it still has some inherent flaws. And so it was in 2002 that an unemployed programmer started to work on a very good idea. Let me tell you about this very good idea. We'd already seen Napster rise and fall, and he decided that there was a better way to distribute information. Let's say that I have a movie, and there's about, say, 150 people in this audience. I've made a short movie, it's only 150 frames. So what I can do is, if everyone in this audience wants a copy of that movie, you can all queue up one after another, and I can each methodically copy the 150 frames and hand them to you. Here you go, and I'll walk through the room and I'll give you all a copy of the film. Okay, and that's how netcasting works. That's how super distribution works. But let's say I do it a little bit differently. Let's say I make a copy of the first frame and I give it to you, and I make a copy of the second frame and I give it to you, and so on and so forth until I've gotten to the end of the room in the 150th frame, and now each of you has a different and unique copy of the film. Just one frame. The next thing that I do is tell you all about each other. And now you start talking amongst yourselves. Oh, you have frame 43, well I need frame 43, and I have frame 63, and you need that, let's trade. And now all of a sudden the burden is off of me to hand you all a copy of the film. All I've had to do is give it out once, and now you folks are all picking up the work. That is called BitTorrent. And here's an example of that in operation. You see all of the different peers with different copies in different parts of the film are all trading with me in the center, and we're all sharing the parts we don't have with each other. And it was good. It was so good that it was revolutionary. Now, the term revolutionary is overused. We understand that revolutionary means it should change everything. But so many people use it for so many weak things that we've come to think, oh yeah, revolutionary, whatever. Well, let me explain why BitTorrent is so good and so revolutionary. It means that one person on one computer with one crappy internet connection can distribute anything to everyone, everywhere, at no cost. Why is that revolutionary? Well, it's a new form of distribution. It's what we're calling hyper-distribution. Because it now means that everyone, everywhere, has the same access to the audience that the distributors used to hold completely to themselves. Now, that means that you, each, me, everyone, we have the same power as a publisher, we have the same power as a broadcaster, we have the same power as a distributor. Now, of course, immediately when someone looks at this, the first thing they think is that this is being used for piracy. Okay, we will stipulate that BitTorrent is being used for piracy. It's not particularly good at it because you have to reveal your IP address, in other words, who you are when you use it, but it's being used for piracy. But it doesn't matter. That's not really what's going on here. That's a lie. It's a MacGuffin. It's a canard. It's taking your eyes off of what the main point is. It's not about piracy. That's the last thing that BitTorrent is about. BitTorrent may have transformed the internet into a giant digital video recorder. It has, because anything that gets broadcast anywhere on television in the world is immediately available everywhere in the world for everybody. But that's a sideshow. That's not really what's going on here. What it means, the most important thing it means, is that everyone has access to the audience. That's disruptive, because the way that the film industry works, the way that the television industry works, the fundamental predication of those industries is that there is a gateway for distribution and that they charge a tax, whether that's advertising that's inserted into a television broadcast or an admission fee that you pay into a movie theater. But there's a tax paid at the point of distribution which allows the entire media machine to fund itself. Well, guess what? The locus of distribution is gone. There is no center anymore. Distribution is now happening everywhere equally, and it's happening more efficiently, because the interesting thing about BitTorrent is that the more people who are trying to share something, the more efficient it becomes for every successive person who's trying to share it. That means that instead of a broadcaster who can only go as far as their beam can go, everyone in the world can now share something, whether it's a television broadcast. Instead of a netcaster who can only do it up to the point where their servers melt down, as more people join in on this, the more efficient it gets for everyone involved. So what this has changed is it's changed a basic axiom about media production. The difference between a professional media person and an amateur media person is that the professional is capable of selling their products into a distribution channel. In other words, if you make a sale, you are suddenly blessed as a professional. And you make a sale because you make a deal with a distributor of some sort, whether it's a TV channel or a movie distributor. And now, everyone's a distributor. So now, what's the difference between a professional and an amateur? Well, let's take a look at what that means, because this is the new world of hyper-distribution. So I want to share with you three different examples of media producers who are working in a hyper-distribution environment. And the first one is, I think, actually my favorite. It's something called Red versus Blue. Now, how many of you have seen Red versus Blue? So, okay, quite a number of you have seen it. Okay. Red versus Blue is what is called a machinima. A machinima is an animation, a 3D animation that's generated by hijacking the output of a video game. In this case, it's the video game Halo, which runs on the Xbox. They'll write a script, they'll tape the actors' voices, then they'll get their shots out of the video game, because they're quite adept at setting up their shots, take the output, drop it into an edit suite, put it all together, and then get it out there. Not hard to do. And it's really good writing, and it tends to be really funny, really well-drawn characters, all the things that you want, even though the animation is really just hijacked Halo. And when they started this up, they realized that they didn't have a lot of money to pay for bandwidth. So they offered it kind of barely, with a very, very small stream of bandwidth if you just wanted to download it off their website. But what they did, since this came out in early 2003, is they said, oh, let's use this brand new BitTorrent thing and see if we can get people to actually start to download our show over BitTorrent. And all of a sudden, they had an audience in the millions. Millions of college kids all over the country and people all across the world were downloading and watching episodes of Red vs. Blue. And this is great, although you have to realize that the characters are copyright Microsoft, because they're coming from a Microsoft video game, and one day Microsoft came calling. And they went, the jig is up. And Microsoft came and said, hey, could you guys do an ad for us? And they did. An advertisement for the developer convention for Microsoft. And if it's a funny ad and it's using the Red versus Blue characters. And they got paid for it to boot. And they sell DVDs. Here's season 4 DVDs. I think they do about 19 episodes per season. They sell all the normal swag, mouse pads, t-shirts, all that stuff. And they were just offered $5 million for the business, and they turned it down. Because it's keeping about 10 people in at least bare money right now. 10 people are working more or less full time on this. So, it's a good business. All right, the next one. This is called Homestar Runner. Now, how many of you know about Homestar Runner? So Homestar Runner is one of those things that if you know about it, you're a mad fan of it. And I have a really good friend who's an absolutely mad fan of it. I'm like, that's okay. But if you're a mad fan of Homestar Runner, you're an absolutely mad fan. This is all done in Flash animation. And it started, basically two brothers started producing it in 1999, and it didn't really go much of anywhere. And then somehow in 2001, it found the right hit in some community, and it spread like wildfire. And now millions of people are watching it and enjoying it. And they make a small fortune basically off of t-shirts. All right? Now, it's not a huge infrastructure to support, but again, you go to their website, you download their episodes for free, you love the characters, and you support them by buying t-shirts with the characters and some of their funny sayings on it. It's a successful business. It's a successful business model. And then, Happy Tree Friends. Now, how many of you have seen Happy Tree Friends? And we'll come to why you've probably seen it. So, for those of you who haven't, it's very difficult to describe except that it's twisted fairy tales for adults. It's very bloody, it's very violent, it's very stupid, and it's very funny. Now, Mondo Media, the folks who create Happy Tree Friends, started in 1996. And they were doing all sorts of webisodics. I think as full disclosure, I remember vaguely working with them about a web webisodic back in 98 or 99 during sort of the peak dot-com era in the United States. I was doing a little writing for them. And somehow they managed, just by sort of clinging on, they managed to survive the entire collapse of the dot-com era, and they just kept at it and kept at it. And finally, in 2002, they got Happy Tree Friends up and running, and they had a hit on their hands. Happy Tree Friends now gets 15 million viewers a month. You can subscribe to it through the iTunes Music Store, so you just have a feed coming in, and you can watch little videos coming in. You can go to their website and you can watch it. And of course, they've now added a 30-second or 15-second ad right before the broadcast. So they're now getting real advertising revenue because people are actually sitting there and watching it in order to get this week's episode of Happy Tree Friends. Plus, there's the normal swag. They do t-shirts, they do stuffed animals, all right? Absolutely, it's a no-brainer because they've got all these cute little animals doing evil things. And so they have stuffed animals, they have t-shirts, they have DVDs, they even sell to broadcast. I was talking to the president of Mondo Media last year, and I said, oh yeah, I've seen you on SBS, because a lot of you have probably seen it on SBS. And he's like, yeah, we really don't make any money off of that. That's really just to get it out there so that more people know about Happy Tree Friends. So the broadcast sale is basically a loss leader. That's how upside down things have become. Their whole point is to get it out there, to get it freely available, to get it in as many heads as possible. So what's the lesson here? This is the first lesson of the law of hyperdistribution. It comes down to a very simple principle. The more something is shared, the more valuable it becomes. Okay, so I've got some bad news. These are three success stories, and I will grant you that these are success stories, but it's my position that they're flukes. They're temporary, and they're growing out of the fact that we're in a transitional period between the era of normal distribution and the era of hyperdistribution. Why? It's because in a transitional period, both systems are still floating around, but we still haven't gotten an entire audience that's fully aware of what they can do, not just as consumers of media, but as producers of media in the age of hyperdistribution. It's going to become common knowledge over about the next 5 years. This is when we're going to see the full extent of the transition. The transition has already started. And you'll know the transition has happened because you'll see two things happening simultaneously. If you look around, you can see the beginnings of them now. The first is that there's about 1,000 times more content out there. That's one thing. And the second is that the professional content is going to be completely enveloped by a tsunami of amateur content. Okay, you're thinking, I don't know if I buy that. You're thinking, but I'm a professional. No matter what I do, it's going to look better. It's going to sound better. It's just going to be better than anything that an amateur vomits up onto YouTube. Well, go on thinking that. I know it's a very comforting thought, and it's going to help you through the very weird days ahead. I was having a violent argument with a panel that I was on in Vancouver between two media producers and me on this point, because one of the producers, who's a good friend of mine, said, Mark, a million monkeys typing on a million keyboards is not going to give you Hamlet. Well, go on telling yourselves that. I have something to tell you that you need to know about, which is going to guide the entire future of media production. Relevance always trumps production values. Consider someone with limited time. We all have limited time in the world, and we're sitting down to do whatever viewing of media that we're going to view. All right, what are we going to watch, and how are we going to come to know to watch it? Now, you have media spheres that can put up all this advertising and all this marketing around you to get a message to go see a movie. But there's going to be 1,000 times, and there already is this growing sea of content out there. How do we know what to watch? How do we know what's good? Well, it's because of the things that we're interested in. It's because of the things that our friends and our family tell us are good. And more of that is coming from places that have nothing to do with mass media. More and more of that is about things that are immediately relevant to us. We will sit through something that's shot badly, that maybe got clumsy writing, that has horrible sound production, if it's speaking directly to us. We will always choose that over something that is really well produced, but is aimed at a mass market. That's the way audiences are now thinking. And that's the way sites like YouTube are designed. YouTube, how many of you have not used YouTube? Get on it. All right? YouTube is now, I think, the 10th most visited site on the internet, coming from nowhere 6 months ago, basically. All right? Because it's all around this idea that your friends can easily find videos and immediately email them to you, or they can take the HTML that's very conveniently provided right there and paste it into their own website so they can drop it into their blog. It's all designed about this idea that you can find something and then share it really quickly, or upload something and share it really quickly. It's all engineered for this idea that this is how we are now sharing media. This is how we're spending our time with media. So instead of a mass market with mass audiences, what we're going into, the world that we can already see growing up around us, is the world of micro audiences. And micro audiences are between a few tens of people to a few thousands of people. And every one of us is a member of micro-audiences right now, and we will be members of more and more micro-audiences, and we will be drawing our viewing options out of that micro-audience. We will also be contributing as creators into that micro-audience, which brings me to my final example. I have a whole group of friends in Seattle, And they do a lot of community theater. They've made some very funny sort of joke DVDs. I participated with them in a version of Jesus Christ Superstar that we did a few years ago at Burning Man. They're actually fairly competent actors. And they're big fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. And they decided that they wanted to do a satirical version of Angel, which they've called Cherub. And they started out last year and they just shot a couple of episodes and they told a few friends about it. They sent me some email. Now, I'm not a fan of either Buffy or Angel. Forgive me, I really like Firefly, all right? But Buffy just doesn't do it for me. And they told a few friends and they got a little better at it. And the more they got better at it, the less sort of satire it became and the more it became its own sort of original story. Now, production values, eh, but they're fun and they're now reaching a few tens of people to a few thousand people, until last week. And last week, there was a full two-page article in Wired about them shooting this TV show in their backyard. And you can go to iTunes and you can subscribe to the podcast feed for all of the episodes of Cherub. They're thinking, okay, this is it. This is the big time. We're going to go massive. And they probably will. They'll go up to 10,000 viewers, maybe 100,000 viewers. They're looking for the big deal. But frankly, I think that the era of those big deals is probably drawing to a close. Maybe they're going to get in right under the line, but I don't know. But it's them, and it's someone like them, and it's someone like them, and so on and so forth. There's a whole army of people with stories to tell, and some of them are going to do it badly, and they're going to learn from that, and they're going to be back, and they'll do it badly again, and they'll learn from that, and they're going to be back, and they're going to be doing it right, and they're going to have the same access to the audience that you did, and they're never going to stop coming. There's going to be wave after wave of them. Here comes everybody. Thank you.